Hello there, and welcome back to the Film Score Podcast. Today will be my annual, quote, best film scores of 2023. And now, as I always say with these types of lists, when you're talking about different types of art, I don't really think there's anything that's actually, quote, the best. How do you determine the best? The best film, the best album, the best film score? These really all come down to what your favorites are. And that's certainly the case with this list. For all intents and purposes, these are my 10 favorite film scores of 2023. I just use best because I need that sweet SEO attention. I've got one other caveat. I don't think these types of lists are set in stone. They're not carved into the side of a mountain. At least, I don't think they should be. They're certainly not for me. Instead, they're ever-changing, ever-in-flux. My 10 favorite right now may not even be the 10 on this list, which I put together over, well, the course of watching and listening last year, and then re-listening and thinking over the last month or so. And yet there are plenty that could have been on here, and maybe if I re-watched or re-listened right now or tomorrow, they would be. Maybe that's a good place to start. A score that, at any given moment, I'm not sure whether I love it or not. And that's The Killer by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Now, don't hate me for listing this. I know that these two catch a lot of flack, and unlike some of their other releases in prior years, this isn't one that was necessarily met with global critical acclaim, or really a lot of attention at all. Part of this is the film itself, which I think left people, many people at least, a bit cold, a bit wondering, what did I really just watch? What was the point of all of this? It reminds me, in one sense, of Leave the World Behind, which, although coming out like 2.5-3 months ago, I still see people routinely complain about, not just the ending, but I think in general feeling as if something was missing, that it ended abruptly, there was nothing there. I didn't feel that way with The Killer, but many people did. I think the score is both a victim of that, but also one of the culprits, one of the perpetrators. Because the music on here is very much in the main style they've cultivated over the last, what's it been, 14 years or so since The Social Network came out, this somewhat distant electronic, stemming from, in many ways, some of the instrumental aspects and interludes of Nine Inch Nails. But The Killer, in one sense, takes this to the extreme. It's very, in many ways, there's an excellent exception to this that I'll mention in a moment, but in many ways it's very distant, very cold, very detached, and when you finish watching the film you have that same feeling, but it pushes the viewer further and further away from Michael Fassbender's titular killer, creating a separation between the two. By doing so, it can very easily, after you listen, leave you with an emptiness, a feeling that something was missing. Oftentimes, that's a very negative response, and yet here it's quite intentional. Caveat, though, the exception, is in the two tracks, The Brute Part 1 and The Brute Part 2, which score the lead-up and then fight between Fassbender and The Brute, a quite large, intimidating man. And especially Part 2, when you listen to it on its own, it's a really interesting mixture of score and sound design, using a lot of silence, a lot of sound effects, by doing that, it puts you right into the moment. It's very visceral, very chaotic, very violent, very brutal. It's a scene I think you could turn on, close your eyes, listen to, and it would be perhaps just as effective. I also think the scores are really not just an interesting parallel to Fassbender's character, but also a funny juxtaposition to the use of the Smiths. Many of their songs are used throughout the film, very emotional, hard-on-your-sleeve type music, polar opposite to Reznor and Ross's score. But to take this back, the score that, in making this list, sometimes I wondered, does it belong on here? Is it in my top 10? Is it in my top 20? I still don't know. But I like it enough in this immediate moment that it belongs, for now. Another one that I really wasn't expecting to put on here is All of Us Strangers by Emilie Levunet-Farouch. She's somebody that I talked to about a month ago, and when I saw the film, it's a beautiful, touching film, I liked the music. I thought it was good. It surprised me in the style. I expected something maybe a bit more overtly emotional and emotive, and perhaps something that could seem more classically lowercase r romantic. But instead, Emilie uses quite a hybrid palette here. It has much more ambience, much more atmosphere. All that together kind of surprised me. Like I said, I liked the score. I thought it was a good score while watching the film. And then, about an hour before I interviewed her, I was listening through the score again and was struck with the most intense wave of melancholy. And it's something I haven't really had listening to, candidly, any music in quite a while. But I think the last time I had that, and this was maybe 2 years ago, listening to Aiko Ishibashi's score for Drive My Car, where partway through that, hearing the delicate music and these nighttime ambiances really pushed me on the verge of tears, and I don't know why, but that moment re-listening to All of Us Strangers did the same for me again. And everybody has different ways that they appreciate music broadly, or film music in particular, looking for different things, different aspects that draw them, catch their ears, say, this is the best favorite. But many times for me, it's, what is the emotional reaction? How does it make me feel? And is that a feeling that I think the film wanted me to feel as well? That's very much the case here. And it's interesting because Emilie and I talked about how she avoided having a score that felt manipulative. It's easy to have this solo, slow piano that tells you, be sad. It's another thing to subconsciously, unknowingly, nudge you toward that direction. And that's what happened here. And it was such a subtly powerful thing. And how could you leave aside something that does push you toward tears? Another score that had certainly similar effects was Lamia's Poem by Christopher Willis. I've been a huge fan of Chris's since I saw The Death of Stalin, where he kind of creates this faux lost late 19th, early 20th century Russian classical score. And he's kept it up since then. His score for The Personal History of David Copperfield, incredible. Can't remember what year that came out, 2019, 2020 perhaps? One of my favorites of that year. And Lamia's Poem is really no different. It's an interesting film in that it takes place both in a relatively modern time, as well as in, I think, a medieval Persia, Iran, maybe? Can't remember off the top of my head. And it jumps between these two timelines, and when it's in the past, it's a sort of fantasy dream world iteration of that past. So there are many different elements that he could have used. Something overtly modern for the modern times, something very traditionally Persian, classically Persian in those moments. And he doesn't quite do either, I would say. It was very intentional not to be overtly Persian and almost stereotypical, something that I think a lot of people in the West, when they're doing things that are in the Middle East, Iran, places like that, hitting a handful of instruments, the same scale, for instance, a wailing woman's vocals, these classic tropes that we hear in the music of film and TV created in a place like the US or the UK that takes place there. And Chris dips his toes into that. He uses some of the instruments, some percussion as well, some of the styling, but it also doesn't feel like the type of thing that you've heard 4,700 other times. It's really respectful, really subtle in these choices. But the strongest part, and maybe for me, one of the two best themes of the year, the other I'd say would be Helena's theme from John Williams' score for Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. But the main theme for Lamia's poem as well is just incredibly, incredibly beautiful. It's something that Chris gets a lot of mileage out of, in both using the theme, but also using fragments of it, extrapolating from it, taking little bits here and there, playing with it, so there's always a sense of familiarity in various melodic fragments, and yet it doesn't become so overused like you get in, not a monothematic score, because this isn't, but in a score that could be monothematic, or that particularly relies on one driving theme. Those often feel, by the end, to have run their course. Lemmy's poem, no such thing. Alright, I've given you a few different ones. Let's get to something more familiar, more mainstream. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse by Daniel Pemberton. I was lucky enough to interview Daniel for this score, before the film came out. And at the time, I think I got, three or four promo tracks on a score that's, let's call it, 35 tracks in like an hour and 40 minutes. And I liked his score for the first Spider-Verse film, and I really like his music overall. Daniel's a great composer, great young composer, still waiting for, I think, the awards acclaim, but Across the Spider-Verse, I think, really, really, really pushed him into everyone's mainstream because the score was so good and so popular. But hearing those first couple tracks, I was like, yeah, this is good. It continues into the Spider-Verse, another good score. I could already tell there was going to be a lot of genre and stylistic diversity, but I did not know what I was in for. And it is such a technically impressive score for two main reasons, I would say. One, the film has a number of characters, a number of these Spider-Man variants, as well as a number of villains that come into play. And Daniel's been able to give them, so many of them, very, very distinct themes and styles to their own. The second part is, these are not themes that exist independently or used independently, and they're not themes that are in a similar sonic palette to one another, to where they can overlap and you've got the same couple instruments playing or be used back to back again with a much more traditional connective tissue. Here you might have hip-hop, punk, you might have something that's a bit more baroque, and he throws them all together, and it should be complete, nonsensical chaos, mixing all of these styles and even more bizarre sounds within them. I mean, sampling the sound of geese at some point. It shouldn't make any sense. It should be a complete, utterly complete disaster. And yet, instead, it's absolutely incredible. There's a scene early on in the film where gets Spider-Gwen is fighting, can't remember, maybe it's the Vulture, who has this very Renaissance style. It's the universe that he comes from. And then you have a couple other Spider-Man variants that come in, and it's jumping between these characters in the middle of the action, and as it's doing so, the music is jumping from character to character, and it should feel like you're skipping on a radio station, or skipping on the most diverse compilation album you could own. And instead, there's a continuity throughout, and it's just astounding that he was able to manage that and to maintain that throughout the entire film and such a long score. There's an album that I heard, I'd say probably 16 or 17 years ago, that was similar, that every 10 seconds it drastically switched genres. I've never been able to find it. I don't remember who it was by, what the band was. Feels like I dreamt it, almost. It doesn't exist. And that, in one sense, was similar in what it tried to do, but it was so jarring. And the jarring, I think there was an intentionality to it. But that approach, it's much easier to be jarring than it is to be seamless. And somehow, Pemberton falls into the latter. Another score that was quite odd was Jerskyn Fendrick's score for Poor Things. I recently had a Twitter discussion that I posed about his score, actually, because I think he had a quote that was that he had written roughly 95% of the score before he had seen the film, through discussions with the director Yorgos Lanthimos, through concept art, production art and information, the script, etc., having effectively all of the information possible other than the filmed picture itself. And it was the question of, well, at that point, are you still scoring, or where do you draw the line between making a production library music and score? In my view, effectively, if you are making music for a film, you're scoring it, and that's that. But beside the point here, this was Fendrick's first feature score, coming off the back of his album Winterreise, which director Lanthimos had heard, and apparently upon hearing it knew that this was the person he wanted and he needed to have score this film. And it is such an obscenely bizarre approach and set of instruments and styles. It feels like, at times, what you're hearing is completely out of tune, or multiple people playing and they can't hear what the other person is playing or the other people are playing. There's a chaos, a cacophony that works in tension, but again, it's purposeful, especially earlier on in the film as we're following Bella and she is very infantile. There's a chaos to her life, to her approach. There's an unknowing for her, and the music reflects that. This stumbling confusion comes out in the music, and yet as the film goes, the music becomes more certain, more confident. The stumbles turn into steps, to jogs, to sprints. More colors are added, the palette fills out. There's a sense of knowledge, of triumph, of growth of the score, and at the same time of the person. Conceptually, I think that's quite a mature approach. And then when you start digging into the instruments, the stylings, it's really going for the home run, for the unorthodox approach, and yet this is not doing so in a small film. Poor Things isn't a blockbuster, but it had a $30-35 million budget, which is substantial. And yet, Fendrick's kept pushing, and he told me, was surprised that even his weirdest moments, in his view, still made it into the final film. And I love that. Now, another weird one that I think almost everyone seems to have forgotten about is Tim Hecker's score for Infinity Pool. And I'll say first, interviewing Tim last February, I think, was perhaps, in my view, the highlight of my 2023 for this podcast. Been a fan of Tim's for 15 years, let's say, on his solo music. I call it ambient. He disagrees, but I've got a feeling he's not listening in at the moment. He's a legend in the field, and so I was really excited that he's seemingly increasingly moving into scoring film and television. And it lets him continue to experiment stylistically and sonically. Infinity Pool is no different. It's the second or third feature from Brandon Cronenberg, David Cronenberg's son. Possessor was another great film, came out about 3 or 4 years ago with Jim Williams scoring. It was kind of like a two-theme, two-motif score there that was very unusual, but a bit more restrained in the scope of what it was doing. Infinity Pool, instead, is like an ever-expanding sonic nightmare. The first moments of the film are this really picturesque beach and resort, and the music is telling you that if you are a tourist here, if you are a visitor, this is going to be the worst vacation you could ever possibly imagine. And so you, as the viewer, get ready to be brutalized. Not brutalized in the sense of a hostel or a turistas or something like that, but in a more interesting, less pure shock and schlock fashion. And then that is exactly what's in store. It is a brutality of weirdness. For instance, Tim spent literally hours looking into the sounds of cicadas, scouring YouTube for various samples, landing on, I believe, a particular sample of Mediterranean cicadas, and then creating what he called a Baltic banjo, intended to fit with this island, which I think is a faux Mediterranean, faux Baltic resort island, resort country. And that becomes a big part of his score and the sonic backbone of it. And it's just an example of the lengths to go to create something that's going to be striking and unusual, and yet when you hear it, although you know it's something that you have never heard in your life, it is also incredibly fitting for it. But it's certainly unorthodox in its approach as film music. And for instance, a narrative and a building arc, which is something about the film itself that's much more focused on the degradation of an individual, of Alexander Skarsgård's character here, and the living nightmare. Much of it comes in the way of almost like a surreal psychedelic imagery. It's a sensory overload, and Hecker's score certainly adds to that. A strength in marrying audio to picture reminded me in one sense of Clint Mansell's score for In the Earth, Ben Wheatley film, which again uses a lot of strange, quick imagery and this very, very bizarre psychedelia in the score that is both unusual and yet extremely fitting. The next two scores I'll talk about have a bit of a thematic kinship. The first is Godzilla Minus One by Naoki Sato, and I've half-jokingly mentioned before that every movie needs to use some of the Godzilla legacy themes. Not just Godzilla films, every film. And it's because these are just so good. And Sato uses some of them, and I'll admit right now, I'm sure that that use clouds my appreciation, my enjoyment of the score. I love those themes so much, so hearing them again in a different context, for a different score, a different film, makes me so happy. And it's a complaint I've had, and I know a lot of others have had, with some of the MonsterVerse scores. It's why, in big part why, at least I think Bear McCreary's score is the best of those, because not only does he use them, but he really understands how to use them. So, big points for Sato in using those well. But there's also a kind of emotive similarity, I think, to the score for Shin Godzilla, which both of these have a real strong emotive resonance. There's something melancholic, intimate about it. It isn't all simply pounding you on the head with the sounds of this giant creature smashing across the landscape. So those suites in particular, utilizing the various legacy themes, are some of the highlights, but in all, it is an impressive balancing of these gargantuan melodies, signifying an almost otherworldly, incomprehensible, destructive presence with something much more personal, more painful. The other nuclear film score is Ludwig Göransson's score for Oppenheimer. I'm recording this before the Academy Awards. I don't know if it'll come out before or after, but I'll assume that Göransson will have won the Oscar for Best Score for Oppenheimer. He's already won the Golden Globe, the BAFTA, number of other accolades, small and large. This seems to be the score critics and filmmakers, etc., have really latched onto. And I think it's quite easy to see and to hear why. Ordinarily, I have a prejudice against scores that are effectively wall-to-wall music in their films. They can suffocate the film. And many times, however, it's a necessity. The film itself may have flaws or deficiencies, and the fix of that in post is to simply throw more music, have the music plastered upon in a type of topical solvent. Oppenheimer, however, is wall-to-wall, but it is intentional, beneficial. It really puts you in the moment. It feels as if the roughly 3-hour runtime, largely of scientists talking to one another, is the most tense, action-packed, fast-paced thing you will, and you have, ever experienced. The music pushes that pace, it's propulsive. It forces you, the viewer, the listener, as well as everything that appears on screen. It immediately starts at 100 miles an hour and very rarely stops, or even slows. And so it is exhausting in the way that a sprint or a marathon would be. It leaves you breathless. But it also has moments where it does cut out entirely. And this is the brilliance of using almost constant music, because the moments of silence, or at least of an absence of music, become so much more powerful. There's an intentionality to it, and when the music dissipates, we know there's something really, really specific and important to focus on, and it enraptures us even more. What little edge of our seat we're on, we get ever closer to the edge. The score itself, the music, the approach is so fascinating here, because it's in many ways Ludwig carrying on from his score for Christopher Nolan's Tenet, which was this very dense, massive, overwhelming hybrid electronic or orchestral score, although people will quibble with that. Oppenheimer has a lot of similarity there, where it, despite being a film that takes place in, the 30s, 40s, 50s, is exceptionally modern. A lot of very cutting-edge electronic aspects, production techniques, mixed in with more traditional instruments, particularly the violin. And you can view it in two ways. You can view it as something anachronistic, and for many that might make it jarring, although I think the imagery of the film itself is certainly, when you're getting into the nuclear aspects, very unorthodox, unusual, and so it fits in there. But you can also view it as an extension of the complex topics, what feels like even for, well, perhaps especially for a layman like myself, it is another language. It feels still exceptionally modern, and so having music that is the same fits right in. Another period score was, actually both of these, my last two, are period scores, although they don't necessarily feel it. The first one up is Killers of the Flower Moon by Robbie Robertson. Of course, the score is kind of overshadowed in some ways by Robertson's death in about the middle of 2023, and I think that heightens the focus on the score and makes us all so lucky that this last piece of his is so exceptional. Of course, Robertson having indigenous ancestry, I think he's 50% Mohawk, I want to say, giving him a deeper connection to the story of Killers of the Flower Moon than most, nearly all, other composers would have. It seems to have been something very resonant with him, and I think it allowed him to tap into that. The score has, and the film itself has, I would say, two different feelings, and one, as time goes on, leads into the other. The first, and you hear it very close to the beginning, when the oil geyser sprouts up, and there's jubilation amidst the Osage community for what they've found. There's a joy, a triumph, a confidence, an expression that these people who have been downtrodden and discriminated against have found a way around that. They've found what they think and what seems in the moment a salvation, and the music celebrates that. But unfortunately, it is a short-lived celebration, and that's where the inflection point of the music comes in as well, where it then becomes a sorrow, a rage, an angst. The Osage and Robertson are shouting out into the sky, into the void, looking for some sort of new salvation, some way to right these wrongs that have been committed against them. And musically, it's a really interesting score because Robertson avoids doing some sort of indigenous trope with the instruments used. You can hear in very many scores of Westerns. And yet he still does incorporate indigenous instrumentation and melodies, and he also avoids more classic Western tropes, using a lot of, I think, more modern approaches, putting it into the past. So you get these swarms of guitars highlighted by flutes, percussion, and it creates this very unusual palette and approach that still feels very natural, works very well. And finally, the last score I'm including is Mark Jenkins' score for Ennismane. This is about as ambient, as droning, as film scores really get. I think it's a score built upon two main themes, done through period synths taking place in the 70s, I want to say, complemented by a lot of found noises. Noises of rocks, of metals, all from Cornwall, where the film takes place, an island off the coast of Cornwall. And that gives it something that's kind of very intimate, very localized, as if it is sound coming from the setting, from the island itself. And it's interesting because the score has a dual effect of heightening the psychedelia and the confusion that we see in the film, sort of this surreal horror, but also by droning on in this ambience, it lulls the listener, it lulls the viewer, it convinces them that perhaps nothing is wrong to chart the next day, continue the menial tasks repeated regularly, and to not question that things perhaps are falling apart. Say, this is one of my more unusual choices, but it's one that really struck me, and it's also one of the rare examples of a score release using dialogue samples, and it working very well. It adds to the isolation, the emptiness, the growing detachment. And I know that depending on where you are in England, you can be fortunate enough, lucky enough to hear Mark Jenkin performing the score live. Something I would be very jealous of, hope to see, hope to experience at some point. But like I said at the beginning, 10 choices, I call them the best, but these are favorites. Plenty I'm sure you can disagree with, and I'll say some of your favorites. Maybe they were number 11, maybe they're number 12, maybe they were number 143. There's maybe 30 different scores that at any point could have been up here in these 10. And it's really a futile exercise to wonder where something was that wasn't on here. There's no point. It's much more interesting to discuss other favorites, why you liked them, why I liked them, or maybe why you or I did not. With that in mind, always interested in hearing what your favorites have been as well. I think depending on how open your ears are, 2023 was another great year.